Welcome, everybody.
8 miles south of the city.
Thank you for coming on this afternoon, and I'm going to introduce you to our presenter, Katrina Katie Hay. I finally got down. So, and Katie is an associate professor of physics at PLU, and her first time in the village, so we're pleased to have her here. And her talk this afternoon is "What is Energy? What Powers Our World?" So thank you.
Great, so thank you. Thank you for braving a physics presentation. I really appreciate you guys coming today. So today, I'm gonna basically talk to you about, like, what we currently use to power our devices and how that process really works. And I'm gonna ask you some questions on the way through, and don't be embarrassed. It's just to keep you engaged and committed to wanting to know the answer to something. My research at PLU, and before that, is fluid physics, and phenomenology is just a way of saying experimentally motivated theories, so empirical formulas, and astronomy. So I do some observational work at our PLU observatory, which is back in use after about a decade. The reason Hanford is up here is because one of the things I studied when I did fluid physics was how to model fluid contaminant flow from the surface to the groundwater. And it turns out it's a lot faster than we predict via, like, just soil seepage. And so we think there's rock fractures down there that is allowing contaminant to get to the groundwater much faster than we predict. And so you need physics to basically describe the shape of the droplets and how they move and how quickly they can go down. And I got to work my dream job for a little bit at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory when I was in graduate school. And that was just a really fun experience. I got to work on the Dawn spacecraft that is currently orbiting around Ceres. And I'll try to speak a little bit louder, maybe I'm not speaking loud enough. It's currently orbiting around Ceres, but it was the only mission to go to two asteroids, Vesta and then Ceres. This is the dry planet and then the wet planet, actually they're asteroids, or protoplanets. I got to write part of the timeline for when the spacecraft was orbiting around Vesta. So the timeline meaning what it was going to do in the order of, like, seconds, turn this way, take a picture, take mosaics, search for moons, that sort of thing, as it was approaching Vesta. So that was a really fun project. I also got to teach about energy at PLU. Chemistry professors might know that we have a J term at PLU, so that's a January term that that we can teach, like, a condensed course, and we often travel during those courses. And so my department, even though we had low staffing this year, they let me do a J term where I took students down the west coast of the United States by train, by the Coast Star Lake Amtrak. It was wonderful. And we stopped and we looked at hydroelectric energy at the Columbia Dam. We went to Oregon State University and looked at ocean wave technology, energy production, nuclear. They have an experimental nuclear reactor. Geothermal, Klamath Falls has got some really great innovative ideas. And then we went all the way down to Southern California to study solar energy, and I made students present on the train on the way back. that was pretty fun. So, also another trivia about me, I wrote a children's book so that I could spread a positive message about science. I want to reach kids before they get negative messages about science, because you know they do. So I wanted to reach them when they're super young, and so that's my trying to reach out to kids with that message. And I put a copy of it in the library if you'd like to look at it. All right, we're going to talk about energy, natural resources, where do they come from, how do we get energy from the natural resources to, like, the outlet in our wall. Basic overview of some of the sources that we use. And I want to discuss the pros and cons of these methods, because there are pros and cons to all methods. Please do interrupt me with questions. Don't feel like you have to sit there quietly. It's a better conversation if you just stop me and ask a question if you have one. However, I will ask you to participate in today's session in discussions and guessing answers to multiple questions. And that's because education research shows that learners who participate or commit to guessing an answer then confront the correct answer a real answer, learn with deeper understanding and retain more of the information. So that's why. Okay, as Bill just mentioned, energy's in the headlines a lot, and I took all of these from NPR, and they're all very recent articles. I'm not going to go into these articles, but I just want you to see that there are, energy is definitely on the minds of a lot of people right now. Tesla begins taking orders for its solar energy roof tile systems. They're everywhere. Oil, gas wells, dot developments, raising potential dangers, struggling nuclear industry, lobbies state government for help. Waste not, want not. Why aren't more farms putting poop to good use? Former Energy Secretary says climate change needs a robust response. What Trump misses about energy jobs in America? Big business pushes coal-friendly Kentucky to embrace renewables. And wind energy takes flight in the heart of Texas oil country. Maybe you can hear me a little better, Stender. Okay. So I'm going to give you some definitions of basic sciences, the categories of sciences here. In physics, we study the study of motion, matter, like mass, objects, and energy, and their interactions between all of those elements. In chemistry, this is very oversimplification, they study composition of substances, properties, and interactions between those. In biology, they study living organisms of all kinds. Geology studies how the Earth is dynamic, it's more large scales and long time scales. And I'd like to present the idea that energy is kind of sandwiched between all of this interdisciplinary action and also politics and society, in which we make decisions about the planet and places value on resources, and we create attitudes toward energy in our culture and for the culture itself. So I'm going to propose that we take a moment to discuss this collection of words that I've put under here, tree, fire, ocean, etc. And maybe around with people around you or on your own, decide which of these categories these items belong to. In other words, if you are going to need one of these systems to analyze the word that's presented there, which one would you choose? Or would you choose an overlap? So take a couple minutes to discuss amongst yourself, and then I'll ask you what you come up with. All right, kind of hearing an ebb and flow to the conversation. And what I'm hearing is maybe what you picked up on that I was... It's kind of a trick question, isn't it? Because most of them, it's hard to fit them into just one category, right? So you can't just be a biologist and study biodiesel. You're going to need some input from a chemist, a mathematician, someone who makes policy. All of these things tend to be interdisciplinary. Did anyone find one that fits into just one category? Any ideas there? There's no wrong answers here. kind of hard to see how that rescues you. Okay, it seems like maybe I'm a little too quiet.
I just think you won't have to yell the whole time. Good idea.
From one who has a quiet voice.
I understand.
Put the towel in the pocket. Oh, let's turn it on first.
Okay.
Can I turn it on?
Yeah, sure. Okay, how does that sound?
A little better.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
You can walk
around. Okay, great. Yes, no cords following me. Okay, great. Excellent. So thank you for playing that game with me. And the point I'm trying to make here is that interdisciplinary knowledge is key to making good decisions as an individual and as a community. I really think that. And I feel like interdisciplinary work and research really is the future, especially of science. I try to encourage my college students to take as many classes outside of their major as possible, just to become really well-rounded and versed in other disciplines. So I keep dropping this word, physics. you might recognize some of these images, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. We study a lot of things in physics. Let me step down here. But what is it that a physicist actually does? When my students graduate, they very rarely go off and become physicists.
as we say it. They're usually just trained in problem solving, and they get hired by lots of other disciplines. And so as physicists, we use the laws of nature and experimental results to model physical systems and solve problems. We embrace uncertainty. Real-world applications can be very complex, influenced by many factors. I mean, you could say climate change. Imagine how many factors you need to predict that kind of thing. Finding fundamental underlying concepts is not always straightforward, and so that's why it takes quite a lot of practice. So, as you imagine, in today's talk, I'd like you to consider a device in your home that requires power. I'm not going to have you tell it to anybody. Just think about the kinds of things in your home. Hair dryer, phone, computer, a refrigerator, oven, depending on what kind of energy you need to power these devices. Fireplace, if you have one of those electric ones or gas ones. Okay, just imagine that. Now let's think about what powers these devices. Powering these devices requires the use of natural resources somehow. One method is it can be direct from the source. Think about just burning wood in your oven like they used to do, or some still do, or a natural gas fireplace. You might be getting it direct from the source. You might be getting the energy that you want right from the natural resource that you have. Or it may be in the form of electricity, which can also be traced back to natural resources, as we will see today. So, what are some of the natural resources that we use to generate energy? Anyone want to call out? I'll just leave love up here because that might be one.
Water.
Oh, this is a dry erase board, isn't it?
Yeah, we can just take this off. It was just love. Very
good. I do
real
like that.
Thing.
I do like that as an energy source. What are some of the things that we use to power?
Water.
Water?
Good.
Wind.
Sun.
Okay.
Wood.
Trees.
Wood.
Coal.
Oil.
Oil, yeah, good.
Gas.
Gas, mm-hmm.
Our legs.
Oh, yes. let's see, let's call that.
Biking legs.
Yeah, okay. Human. Human power.
Geothermal.
Oh, good one.
Cow paws.
I like that. Cow paws.
Uranium.
I was going to say, we're missing. Anything else? And hopefully in the future we can have more to this list.
Wind. We have wind.
Wind, yep, we got wind. Water, wind, sun.
There it is. Sorry.
I went across on the top, sorry about that. Okay, great. Good list. Wow, you guys. Look how small a group we are. We came up with so many. And I will say here, keep in mind that all energy production methods have advantages and disadvantages. I would say there's not one that's perfect, not a single one. But we can work with them and make them more efficient and minimize our impact. So we use natural resources to produce energy mainly for power, in other words, electricity, like what's coming out of the wall outlet, and for transportation in the form of fuel. Energy sources are divided into two categories: renewable, which is an energy source that can be easily replenished, or non-renewable, which is an energy source that cannot be easily replenished. And we'll kind of, that definition is not completely black or white, so we'll talk about that a little bit more. So here's some examples. Non-renewable energy sources like petroleum products, hydrocarbon gas liquids, natural gas, coal, nuclear energy, and then renewable energy sources would be like solar, geothermal, look how good our list is, even more so, wind energy, biomass from plants, hydropower from flowing water. Some energy production forms in a different kind of, I'm going to categorize them a little bit different. These are resources that we've used mostly on Earth currently and in the past. Fossil fuels, not renewable. Nuclear power plant, not renewable. Hydroelectricity, usually considered renewable, and there's policy behind why I took the word usually considered. Wood burning, considered renewable, major source used for centuries before we found any of these other sources. The resources used least are surprisingly most of the renewable energy sources. So solar, biofuels, wind, geothermal, ocean wave technology, lunar energy, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow at the innovative talk. And it's not what you think it is. and there's lots of other innovations that I'd like to share with you tomorrow. Today we're just going to cover basically like how devices are powered. Let's see, did we cover any of the, I think we just categorized most of these. Excellent. Okay, I just wanted to make sure we got them all. All right, this is from the Energy Information Administration, EIA. Non-renewable energy sources accounted for about 90% of all energy used. Biomass, which includes wood, biofuels, and biowaste, is the largest renewable energy source, and it accounted for about half of all renewable energy and about 5% of total U.S. energy consumption in the last year. This is what that was referring to. I'm going to throw a few graphs at you, so you've just got four slides of a couple graphs here. There's a lot of information on it, but what I want you to get out of this is the U.S. energy consumption by energy source just in the year 2016. Oh, that's hard to read, isn't it? Okay, so this says coal 15%. So notice the red, blue, and dark blue categories are all fossil fuels. All of these are fossil fuels. That means petroleum, natural gas, and coal. We're going to talk in a minute about what fossil fuels really are. And what's left over is a little bit from nuclear and a little bit even smaller renewable energy, and those renewable energies can be broken up to all of these right here: hydroelectric, wood, biofuels. So you've got these three categories of biofuel: geothermal, solar, and wind. Okay, so this is not just the current year, which was just that one, actually, well, down here in 2016. This is the history of energy production back to just 1850. Before that was mostly wood. So notice that even in 1850, we had, what is this? This is coal. Yes, even in 1850, they were using coal. Wood mostly before that, but notice the steep drop-off with wood once we recognized that coal was a pretty valuable resource, or burned more efficiently and hotter than wood. And we've had hydroelectric, or water production energy, that little blue source, for quite a while. These are amounts, like percentages added up. And then notice this swift increase of the use of oil. We're going to talk about that in a second. And then we've got gas and nuclear is up there at the top. And where's the pink? Wow, that's so small. Look at how little we use of renewables. It's tiny. It's just that little tiny little blurb up at the top there. All right. So,
oh, why is there no oil in the 1890s or so?
No oil in the, let's see.
Yes.
Yes. It goes and then it...
The next one to the right, there's no oil. No, to the left now.
Oh, this one.
The green is oil, and there's no green. There's red and blue and then coal, whatever, and there's no oil.
Next door.
In between those two.
Sorry, I'm not seeing what you're talking about.
The one over from the start.
The gap in between.
There.
Oh, no green. You know what? That's probably a mistake.
Also, I thought there was a better answer than that, so.
Does anyone have an answer to that? I'm not actually sure. Was there something special that happened in the 1890s?
They discovered gas.
They just threw it out the window. I hadn't noticed that when I saw that.
Like, can you back up a slide real quick? Because isn't renewables 10%?
No. That's in 2016.
Yeah, this is 2016.
So, 2016. So if you go ahead again, what's the, okay.
Yeah, so they've really taken off.
They've
really taken off in the 2000s, which is good. And this only goes,
goes to
2000. Yeah, sorry about that. I'm going too quickly. Yeah, that's interesting. Wow, way to pick that up. Good eyes.
Yeah.
So I've got a question about this for you. I'm going to give you a few seconds to think through this, and then I want you to just show me your answer. You don't have to show it to anyone else, and don't look around the room to look at anybody else's answer. This is just information for me, and then I'll tell you what I'm seeing, and I won't point anyone out or embarrass anybody. Why do you think there was a swift increase in oil between 1900 and 1950?
1901 cars were made, but but I don't think that was the last.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead and take a guess if you haven't already. All right, I'm seeing a mix of A's, B's, and C's, and I'm seeing one combination of these two, which is quite clever. I actually think that this is great. Thank you for that feedback. So I saw a mix of all of these. I actually kind of think I wrote this as the correct answer, but actually I think it's kind of a combination of these two. The increase in oil demand kind of went up, as you said, with the invention of the automobile and like very common usage of it. I think in the beginning they were trying to decide which kind of fuel would be the fuel that they use for it, or nobody was thinking like well into the future, maybe Benz or Daimler was thinking that, but the invention of the automobile, and it did turn out to be a fuel that was useful, and that kind of goes with the drop-off of wood there too. So how do we use these resources in the U.S.? We use them for commercial reasons, residential, like houses. We use them for transportation. Think about like airlines and trains and cars. And industry. So this is kind of the breakdown of how we use these energy sources. This is another historical one. I think this is the last graph I'm going to show you. So you can see at the very bottom here, I'd like to point out that the green line is renewable energy. And it just starts to pick up rather dramatically just in the early 2000s. But notice that throughout history, again, we have used fossil fuels or oil quite remarkably. Coal and gas. And in the bottom here, we've got hydro kind of remaining somewhat stagnant throughout the history, at least from the middle of the 1900s. And then an increase in nuclear here, and then a slight increase, like I said, with renewables at the end there. So what are fossil fuels? I keep using that word. Fossil fuels, we consider fossil fuels as crude oil, natural gas, and coal. Those are called fossil fuels. Fossil fuels were formed over millions of years by the action of heat from the Earth's core and pressure from rock and soil on the remains, or fossils, of dead plants and creatures like microscopic diatoms. Most of the petroleum products consumed in the United States are made from crude oil, but petroleum liquids can also be made from natural gas and coal. Fossil fuels can be traced back to, what do you think? Energy from the sun, energy from inside the earth, energy from the sun and inside the earth, or none of these. Okay, so feel free to hold those up if you want to. I'm seeing at least one of all of these. Interesting, I'd like to hear some of those answers and reasons. So, let's see. Can someone make a case for fossil fuels being traced back to energy from the sun? Anybody want to do that? Can you make a case for energy from the sun?
So the sun grew the plant material?
Yeah.
So forth.
That's kind of that's a major way to get back to this. So the fossils were living organisms, and they had to grow on planet Earth. They either ate plants that grew via the sun, or they themselves are plants and grew via the sun. Also needed other things on the Earth. And then what caused them to, over those millions of years, what happened? What did we need to make those fossil fuels? Yeah, compression and heat, exactly. The hand motions from the inside of the earth. So I would say that the correct answer is C, energy from the sun and inside the earth. I did see some D answers. If you want to, you're welcome to speak up and tell me if you think there's another one, perhaps, that I'm missing here. Okay, just want to check and make sure. Okay, so energy from the sun grew those things in the first place, and then energy from inside the earth compacted them and made them into fossil fuel sources. Now we'll just talk about this. Okay, how do we use them? Well, the fossil fuels are either hydrocarbons or coal, and the hydrocarbons can be broken further down into oil or gas, and all of these require some kind of refinement. Oil is mostly used for transportation, and gas and coal are mostly used in power plants for electricity. Okay, a little bit of physics here. What is energy? It's a property of matter that can be transmitted to other matter. It's a property of matter such that the total quantity of this property in the universe seems to be constant. And if you're going to be smart about it. It can actually be exchanged with mass, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. So energy can be from, just in physics in general, gravity, motion, springs, light, sound, and any force that moves an object, electromagnetics, etc. So I'd like to give you a brief rundown of history of energy, and I know this doesn't include everything, so there's a lot more to it than this, but in the prehistoric era, energy came from brute strength, especially the use of animals. Think about like horses pulling carts. 1 million BC, humans learned to control fire, that's approximate. Fire was used to cook, heat shelters, and protect from animals at that point. So this was our energy usage on the planet. 1 million BC. 3000 BC, Chinese discovered a magnetic force, which is going to become important in our modern day power plants, magnetism, and it was in the form of iron. 1200 BC, Polynesian people learned to use wind as propulsion for sails, and now you could travel further across large water basins, water sea. 1000 BC, Chinese found coal burned longer than wood and gave off more heat. And so in 1275 AD, Marco Polo returned to Italy from China, introducing coal to the Western world. 500 BC, electrostatic force discovered by Greek philosophers Thales. Rubbing fur on amber created a force that would attract dust. So this is the beginning of electromagnetics here, 500 BC. In the 1600s, we're going to skip ahead quite a bit, Netherlands found coal, mined it, and provided it to England and other countries nearby. Also, the Europeans learned to enclose solar heat in glass greenhouses and create indoor warmth. So they're starting to use solar energy as direct thermal use. The 1700s, England had depleted many of its forests for wood burning and turned to mostly coal power after that. 1700s, steam engines were invented, which required coal in the form that they had made them. Efficiency was improved by scientists and engineers throughout the century. The 1800s, industrial revolution started in England, and then in Europe, and then in North America and beyond. Machines made clothing, furniture, and other products. Demand for energy increased dramatically. In 1804, the first steam engine, and then later, the first steam boat. Some scientists, this is fascinating to me, in the 1800s, were already becoming concerned about exhaust from burning fossil fuels and began developing other energy sources, such as solar energy, for heating use mostly, hydroelectric energy, and geothermal energy. In the 1800s, we were thinking about that. 1820, H.C. Ørsted, it's a French name, I believe, saw a magnetic compass react to electric current. Aha, there's a relationship between electricity and magnetism, two things that previously thought were not related at all. This is the beginning of some really fascinating physics. In 1820, André-Marie Ampère, his experiment, a magnet moved through a coil, causing a current in the loop, and I'm going to show you that demonstration later today. In 1831, Michael Faraday, you're really going to like him, he's so cool, what a great experimentalist. He did an experiment where a loop of current induces a current in a second non-attached loop. So this is fascinating, you can create current, like electrical current in one loop with something else, either a magnet or another current loop, not even touching it. Think about your electric toothbrush. You're always like, it's plastic against plastic. What is happening here? Like, where's the current coming from? Well, that's how you do it with one of Faraday's experiments, trying to get current to move in something from something else without having any contact between the two. In 1856 to 1861, James Clerk Maxwell, very famous in physics, there's like whole courses developed around Maxwell's equations, develops field formalism and ties it all together with four really elegant physics equations that physicists just fawn over. And just as a trivia, in 1861, just a claim for physics, he presented the world's first color photograph. 1861! How about that? Late 1800s, Colonel Edwin Drake drilled to extract petroleum oil from the ground in Pennsylvania. This led to kerosene lamps,
gasoline to automobiles, petroleum products.
And saving the whale.
Oh, yes.
Saving the whales.
Thank you for saying that. Yes, because before that we were using a lot of product from whales. Yes, thank you for saying that. Yes. That's so funny that you said that because my husband said I should add that to this slide. And I was like, oh, it's not big. You've just validated his opinion. He's listening.
Is over. He over there?
Yeah. Yeah. Welcome. 1885, German inventors Daimler and Benz, yes, that Benz, invented the automobile. 1900s, French inventor Lenoir invented the internal combustion engine that used gasoline as fuel instead of coal. 1903, Wright brothers made the historical first flight of an airplane, which led to airplanes with gasoline engines. Ooh, huge energy burner there. 1913, Henry Ford put automobiles into mass production, which meant faster, cheaper transportation, but still lots of energy use. 1900, the famous Einstein made several world-changing discoveries. One of them is the link between energy and mass. This was 1905 when this really happened, and I recommend if you could find a book about what happened really in that year of 1905, possibly the greatest year of science ever. The things that were going on with Einstein and in his mind and in the culture and all those things that are intersecting is totally fascinating. So he finds this mysterious link between energy and mass. Before 1905, physicists said energy is conserved, mass is conserved separately, and after that, we cannot say that anymore. Energy and mass are different representations of the same thing. It gives me goosebumps just thinking of it, just mass. This could be converted into energy. A whole lot of energy, and we'll talk about that in a moment. 1940s, World War II pushed scientists in several countries, including Germany and the United States, to a race to create the first atomic bomb, moving nuclear science forward and unleashing devastating weapons never seen before on Earth. Another note about that, there's a really fascinating play. I think it's called Copenhagen. Has anybody seen that? It was made into a movie. I highly recommend it. It was made into a movie, and it's about the a mysterious meeting between Heisenberg and Bohr, two physicists, basically representing two different countries at that point, having this really subtle conversation of trying not to share things that they're not supposed to share about basically weapon secrets with each other, and it's fascinating. The movie, it's a movie, but it's also a play called Copenhagen. It's a little bit slow-paced, make sure you're well awake when you watch it, but it is amazing. I tried to show it to my modern physics students, and we got through most of it. We needed some popcorn to get through the rest of it. 1973, oil crisis. Mideast countries cut off exports of petroleum to Western countries as a punishment for the involvement in the Arab-Israeli conflict, and so we had like hysteria over gas prices and that sort of thing. I see some nodding heads. So in the modern times, eventual depletion of fossil fuels are expected, and damage to the environment causes scientists to search for alternative energy sources including wind, solar, hydroelectric, biomass, geothermal, and nuclear energy. So we've been using kind of the easiest ones to access, but we've been depleting them, and it is dangerous for all of us. So the bottom line, I think, is that energy that has sustained civilization for centuries and beyond, fossil fuels, has been abused and may have only a few hundred years left or less, depending on, it's really difficult to predict this, depending on many factors. Whatever energy source the future holds, we must learn to conserve it and value it. All right, you ready for a little bit more physics? I don't want to move too fast. If you need a break, just let me know. Again, my brain is full, I just need 5 minutes off. Definition, that's what my students say, stop, I just have to take time. Definition of energy is the ability to do work. Now, work doesn't mean the same thing as what we use in modern, like my students would say, it took a lot of work to write that essay, and I'd say, no, it didn't. That's not how we use the word work. So what is work? Well, suppose you pull on a string attached to a box that moves across the floor. The work done on the box by you is the force of your pulling in the direction of motion times the distance displaced. So in other words, let me spoil it down here. Work is associated with force of pulling and distance. So some kind of force, pushing or pulling, whatever, and the distance moved. So you have to move a displacement in order to have positive work or non-zero work. So you have to move in the direction of the force to have work. So here's a little quiz for you. In physics, which are correct uses of the word work? When my students say these things and I say, careful. Take a moment to look through these. You're already ready for it. Okay. All right, I'm seeing mostly D and some B. Interesting. So there's some possible questions about this one. It sure does feel like you do a lot of work when you do isometric exercises. Have you ever done a plank? You know, that feels like a lot of work, right? Nope, not in physics. The physics answer would be D, 2 and 4. The only ones that count as real work is applying a force and moving a displacement. So it took some work to run up those stairs. If you think about it, you're applying a force to the stair and you are displacing your body upwards out across the stair. So there's a displacement and a force. I did a lot of work when I wrote that essay. My very snarky students will say, well, what if I use one of those old computers with the clickety-clackety things and my fingers press down the keys? And I'm like, okay. You applied a force to the key and it displaced downward. Therefore, it took you a lot of work, but it wasn't the kind of... And then the other ones would say, what about all the neurons moving around in my brain? I'm like, fine, you burned calories. Okay, that was a lot of work too. So, my original answer is 2 and 4, but I'm just imagining what my students would say. They'd be snarky about a bunch of these things. You know the snarky students. In common language, work and effort mean the same thing, but in physics, we only give credit for displaced results if an object is moved while a force is applied in the direction of motion. Okay, so let's go back to our definition of energy. The ability to do work. In other words, it's the ability to move things like electric charges, for example, through a wire, which is electricity. So this is all for a reason, it's not just for fun. And if you want to know, power is work per time. Power is the rate of change of work. And this is how I remember this. Superman is more powerful because while he may be able to do the same amount of work as we can, say pushing a car across the street, he can do it in less time, which decreases the denominator of this equation, so that would make him more powerful than we are. So it's already a rate of change. That's something that confuses some people. Energy and power are not the same thing. Basic energy forms. So we have mechanical energy, which is basically moving things or something that's higher up. I give this object more energy if I lift it higher up. That's energy based on position. I'm not moving it, I'm just holding it up there, but I used my breakfast of delicious oatmeal to burn calories to bring this up to a higher height. I transferred energy to the, I gotta figure out what this thing's called, Kensington, which is the brand name for it, up higher, and I've given it more energy, I've stored energy. You can imagine you could do the same thing with water. If water rises, it has more energy, and then it stores all that energy and convert it into kinetic energy by falling down. Heat energy, vibrating molecules, basically heat, what we think of as heat. Electric energy, moving electrons. So all of these things are very similar to moving objects or position objects. So these are just moving things. Light energy, that's a very different kind of energy. Those are electromagnetic waves. Chemical energy, energy from breaking or making molecules, not making a new element necessarily. You probably want to add a correction to that, so feel free to speak up. Nuclear energy, energy from separating or combining the nucleus of an element, creating a different element. So these two are different. You can transfer energy. Energy can be transferred by doing work. For example, you do work on by applying a force to a car. Let's go back to pushing a car. The force causes motion, and now the moving car has kinetic energy. In other words, you transferred energy, calories you ate for breakfast, to the car, which now has motion energy. And the thing about energy, it's neither created nor destroyed. It can only be transferred. Sometimes we say energy is lost to heat or friction, but really we mean that it is never lost, just changed to a non-usable form, like friction. I mean, if you rub your hands together, now you've created heat in the air, which disperses rather quickly, and that's really not usable by anybody. It was the calories which was stored in your body, but now it's just dispersed into the air as heat. So I've got a question for you. Perpetual motion machine. I hear one student came into my office once and was like, all right, I've got a perpetual motion machine and it's gonna run forever. And he came in, he closed my door and he was like, I haven't published this yet, so please keep it secret. And he started drawing on my board. I had to
give him the bad news after we discovered where the losses might be. He was pretty disappointed, but this happens quite a lot. Yes, the non-published results that come into the office and, and say, I need to run by some physics concepts. A perpetual motion machine converts one form of energy into another and then back into its original form, creating a loop. Some perpetual motion machines last a while, but none will last forever, not a single one. You can always find some form of loss. Example, so you have an electric generator, turned by a steam jet, which is coming out here, pushing downward. It's running electricity through here, which is heating a coil. This is kind of like putting a light bulb, a well-insulated light bulb, into this basin of water. So it's heating the water, an old-fashioned light bulb, that is. And then that's boiling the water, perhaps, and it's creating steam, which goes up here and is pushed out and becomes a jet. And then it's collected down here and goes back into being the water there. So my question for you is, where might energy be lost in this machine? Why won't it last forever? Anybody see that? There might be a few answers. Oh, possibly in the wires. So these wires have some resistance. That's really good, Bob. These wires have some resistance. So it's kind of like water flowing through a river. There's rocks in the river. It's not quite a perfectly smooth path for that water to flow. So same thing with electrons through a wire.
Being radiated from the equipment to the air around.
Yeah, I was thinking, even if you insulated this really well, over time the heat would come out from there. Yeah, that's good. That's great. What else?
Basically every point in it.
Yeah, like friction in the turbine. Does all this steam really go back in here? No.
Absorption.
Yeah, there's some absorption. This is going to humidify the air. Maybe that's what this really is, a humidifier. And it's going to use some electricity. Yeah, so this won't last forever. No perpetual motion really will, because we've got these energy sources that are lost. So the point I'm trying to make here is that even if we're like transferring energy across large distances, what makes that really efficient is high voltages, but even traveling through wires lose energy. And so like you can make that really efficient, but you're always going to lose some in transferring one form to another. Okay, I'm just going to look at the clock and make sure I'm not running too long. How does a power station really work? This is just the general process, and then I'm going to give you some specific methods. So we have whatever the natural resource is, those things mostly, and it's processed, for example, it's burned. It heats a fluid. This is so, it's so funny to me that we have all this like modern technology, and we just go back to burning things and making steam. The steam moves a turbine. The turbine rotates an electric motor, and I'm going to show you how this happens. It induces an alternating current in a wire, and this current is the electricity that's moved at high voltage through power lines to power homes and businesses. In general, that's how it works. Can you believe? Even if we have these amazing new natural resources, all we do is heat water with it and make steam. It's crazy. All power plants. Most power plants look like this, and the exception is solar power and a few others, and I'm going to present some of that information. Okay, I just used this word induction, and I want to show you what that is. In the 1800s, it was a really exciting time for physics. Michael Faraday discovered that magnetism and electricity are linked. In other words, what he discovered was that a changing magnetic field, not a stationary one, a changing magnetic field near a coil of wire will induce a current in that wire without even touching it. And I want to show you a demonstration of that. So first what I've got here is this just a copper wire wrapped around a coil here. So I've just got this wire. Physics demos always go like this. Nothing up this sleeve, nothing up this sleeve. It's just a coil of wire, just some wires connected to this thing that's called a galvanometer. The galvanometer measures current. It just shows you, it's basically in place of a light bulb. It just shows you that there's current running through here if this thing is anything but zero, which is what it's set at right now. Okay, and what I have here is just a regular magnet. You can see that it's got a red north and a blue south, and if you watch the compass, you can see that it's just a north-south magnet. I'm sorry, I'll try to hold it up a little bit higher. So that's a compass. It's measuring that this is a real magnet. Now, I'll try and do this so that you can see it. If I place it in the... No, maybe not there. Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to push the magnet through the coil. This is just plastic wrapped. And it's not going to touch the wire, but watch the galvanometer here. This is what Michael Faraday saw. Oops. See that? And the faster I move the magnet, but what happens when that, watch this, what happens when the magnet is pushed inside, and now the magnet is inside the coil, but I'm not moving it. What's happening now? Nothing. So what has to happen is I have to use my energy to move the magnet to create an electric current in here. It doesn't happen when the magnet is stationary. What has to happen is a changing magnetic field. Magnetic field has to be changing inside the coil or through the coil in order to generate an electric current here. So that's how we have to do that. Whoops, I forgot I was supposed to ask my kids to help me with that demo. Do you want to do this one with me? Do you want to come up here, one of you? Can you hold this part for me? Can you hold that part for me? Just hold it just like that. And can you hold this part for me? Stand over here. Okay. Watch that needle right there. Whew. All right. Very good, girls. Thank you. Excellent. Okay. And if I had a light bulb attached there, you might see it light up, but you have to move very, very fast to get that to happen. So I happen to have this other electric motor, which is basically the same concept. I'll try to stand a little bit different. I think I can see most everybody now. So what's going to happen? Oh, I don't have a light bulb in there. It's nothing. Nothing's going to happen until I put a light bulb in there. I transported it without the light bulb, not to break it. Okay, so this has the same elements to it. It's got a coil of wire. You can see this wrap of wire in there. And the red thing is a magnet. Sorry for huffing into the microphone. Okay, this is going to happen really fast, and I sure hope it works. I'm going to pull this, and it's basically going to spin that coil really fast in there. And let's hope we get a little bit of a light bulb. Yeah, so that's basically this. Except I tried it with a light bulb, and I just couldn't do it fast enough. So this spins it just long enough. So what I did was I converted energy. I transferred what I ate for breakfast to energy of motion to electricity. That's what happens inside of a power plant. Something has to be moving, and you have a relationship between electricity and magnetism to create the power that runs through our copper wires. A nice application of this is this very dirty shake flashlight. You can see there's a coil and a magnet. Usually you can't see it at all. What's happening in here is there's this brown thing that is a coil of wire, and there's a bar magnet running through it, and I can shake it. Sorry, just like that, converting all my energy to huffing in the microphone. And now I can shine a light. So I've just created and stored electricity. There's obviously a little more to it, some circuitry to store the energy for a little bit. But basically, that's an direct application of Michael Faraday's work. Yeah. Interestingly, Faraday didn't have the mathematical expertise, you might appreciate this, to actually put it all together to become Maxwell's equations. He actually put it together and discovered that the Maxwell's equations were light waves. They could only travel at the speed of light. They were waves that traveled at the speed of light. And so electromagnetism is actually light itself. Michael Faraday had all that information, and he was like, I'm out of breath because this is so exciting. He was like on his, it was the end of his life, and Maxwell came to him and said, I figured it out. You were right all along. This happens at the speed of light. He had thought all of his life that electricity and magnetism were related to optics or light, and Maxwell came along with the mathematical expertise to prove that for him. Before he died, he got to know that he was right. Yeah, isn't that cool? All
right, yeah, that doesn't always happen.
Yes, sometimes those two things don't link up for centuries, huh?
Yeah, and one of the things I just wanted to mention is that we have a really great example of that right here on site.
Yes, the hydropower, right?
At our hydro. And there's probably a tour of the hydro.
We're going to arrange that.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay, I was hoping. I was going to ask somebody if we could go.
You got your guy right here.
Excellent. Thank you for saying that. Excellent. Very good. Yeah. Einstein's waves in 1905 were predicted, but not discovered until a century later. Even so, some of these things don't really match up. I would love to see that. Hydropower, damn, you've got. or facility. Okay, ready to move on? I see everybody's kind of still here. No one's quite asleep yet. Thank you for that. But how do we get energy from hydroelectric, nuclear, solar, and biofuels? The rest of them I'll cover tomorrow. Does anybody need a break? No, really? Fascinating. Okay. Hydropower. Just what you said. This is what Holden Village uses mostly for hydroelectric power. These are my students when we went to the Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River. A dam or a turbine is built across or through a river. Water flows through the dam, spinning turbines. Turbine rotates an electric motor, just like we did here. The motor generates electricity. That's how the dam works. And you should have heard my students when we went to the when we went to the dam for our tour. The jokes just did not cease, and they did not cease to be funny either. We're going. Did you see the damn turbine? Move out of the way, I can't get a damn view. It was all there. I'm going on a damn tour. College students, it's never not funny. Okay. Hydropower can be traced back to the sun, actually. So a lot of our energy comes from the sun. Can anybody explain why hydropower really comes from the sun? What's that?
Melting snow.
Melting snow, okay. Yes, that's part of it. And what's the rest of it?
Evaporation.
Yeah, that's right. This process. Okay, so we're taking, the sun is evaporating water from large water basins, and it is putting it up into the atmosphere, and then it's raining down on top of the mountaintops, and then it's flowing down, or it's melting as snow all the way down, and now you've got the sun basically driving hydropower, driving the motion of the water in the first place. So a lot of these things could be traced back to the sun, or interior of the earth, like we saw with fossil fuels. Okay, can anyone come up with, and there are both, pros and cons to hydroelectric power?
Fish,
that's a big one, yes. Especially fish that like to swim upriver, right, like salmon. And they say that salmon fish ladders solve some of this, but not all of it. It really is damaging to some of them. And through the ones that go through the turbine, right? Anything else? I'm gonna show you my list, but I wanna see it.
Flooding,
yes, you're right. That's one I didn't come up with.
Location.
Yes, yeah. Everyone says not in my backyard.
Right.
Yeah.
Silt buildup.
What's that?
Silt buildup.
Oh, yes. You actually change the environment right there a little bit. Anything else? What are some of the benefits of using hydropower?
Zero CO2.
Yeah.
Near zero.
Reduce the emission. Basically, the pros of any renewable source is not using fossil fuels and creating that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
It's kind of directly used straight to the electricity.
Yeah.
You don't have to go through anything.
Mm-hmm. You can put it right there next to the city where you're at,
yeah,
and use it in that city. Yeah.
Here in Holden Village,
yeah,
one of the cons would be the seasonal effects of,
yes,
the water supply.
Yeah, so in the winter, there's less power to be had. Yeah, thank you.
Right,
that's
right when you need it the most.
Ah, yes, okay, good. We know this a little too well, it sounds like. Okay, here's some of the ones I came up with, which you basically just listed out for me. Reduces the amount of electricity from fossil fuels. It can be intentionally variable. In other words, if you've got a really big dam like Hydro, like the Bonneville Dam, they actually don't use some of the turbines sometimes. They pull them up out of the water, and the water can flow right through it. So it can be allowed to flow through without obstruction at low peak usage times of electricity. So you cannot generate electricity if you don't need it. Cons, changes the ecology and the physical characteristics of the river or the reservoir. Oh, that's so nice. That is beautiful. Hydropower turbines kill and injure some of the fish that pass through, especially fish trying to swim upstream, like salmon. Fish ladders can help, but they don't totally solve or alleviate this problem. The dam must be made from something,
yeah,
rare earth, minerals, metals, concrete from fossil fuels. That's the thing that people often forget. These things have to be made from something,
yeah,
even solar panels. All right. Nuclear power.
Oh boy.
I know. people just understand this is rather complex. People get PhDs in this subject, and I'm going to just try to give you like a brief overview of this. So let me just lead you through. This is an atomic model. I realize this is probably very upsetting to the chemists here, that it doesn't actually look like planets orbiting something. It's an electron cloud, and so this is a very primitive model of the atom. It doesn't really look like this. On the quantum scale, objects are so bizarre, they don't really act like mechanical objects that we're familiar with, macroscopic objects. But in this atomic model, I do want you to notice some of the important features here. The cloud of electrons that can be moved or shared with other atoms is negatively charged. So the point I'm trying to make here is the black things on the outside, or what's on the outside of the perimeter of the atom, is negatively charged. The stuff on the inside, I know it's just total oversimplification, is it's called the nucleus. It's made up of either neutral or positively charged things. So here's the confusing thing for you. If you first learned about an atom and you're like, okay, there's a bunch of negative stuff out here, there's a bunch of positive stuff out here, this is really small and compact, you might say to yourself, so what holds the nucleus together? What holds it so tightly bonded together? It's full of charges that should repel each other, right? That's what Maxwell's equations tell us, that James Clerk Maxwell. It says that like charges repel, and those protons should not be clinging together like that. Well, it turns out there's something else involved here. What holds the nucleus so tightly bonded together is the strong force. This force is so strong that breaking apart the nucleus, and this process is called nuclear fission, would release an enormous amount of energy. It's so strong. How do we know this happens? Well, we've got two major reasons that we know this happens. Einstein really helped with that, and I mentioned that we would talk about this. The nuclear reaction is a consequence of Einstein's famous discovery in 1905 that energy is related to mass and the speed of light squared. Now, if you're familiar with the speed of light, it is very, very, very fast. You might notice when you turn on a light, like really far away from you, it comes to you almost immediately. It's very, very, very fast. The speed of light is super fast. So look at what's happening here. You can get energy from something pretty small, and you get a lot of energy because you multiply it by something really big. This is really big by itself. This squared is enormous. So you take a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of mass, and you can get an enormous amount of energy out of it. What's the other reason we know this can happen? We've seen it in this very unfortunate, violent application of E equals MC squared. This is a release on our planet in 1945 on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. The atomic bomb is a violent application of this equation. And I will note that the reason Einstein pursued this equation was he was so impressed by the work of James Clerk Maxwell. Can you imagine? Einstein had this like idol that he wanted to do something like Maxwell did in uniting the forces and sharing with his friend Faraday that he was right about light. Maxwell united electricity and magnetism, and so Einstein spent his life seeking for other big connections across physics. This was one of them, the connection between energy and mass, two concepts we once thought of as completely different things. Okay, so that's here's the nuclear fission process. Basically, you have this chamber inside of a nuclear reactor, and you've got two, it's basically got some kind of fluid in it, some kind of fluid that the reactor is all in. It's got two different kinds of rods. You've got fuel rods made of uranium, and you've got basically control rods. They're called control rods that absorb neutrons. Okay, so a neutron comes in and hits a uranium atom in the fuel rod. The uranium atom nucleus splits, releasing energy. So it releases not only energy, but it releases more neutrons, and other radioactive elements are left behind from this reaction. The process continues because more neutrons are created and bombarded into other uranium atoms. The process continued until the desired heat in the fluid is created. And then you lower the control rods into the tank, and the control rods absorb neutrons. So it stops the process. All nuclear power plants use this nuclear fission. And then, as we said before, water is heated to make steam, and that steam runs a turbine to generate electricity. You've got this amazing like modern physics application, and all you're doing is heating it to make steam to run a turbine. Yeah, okay. Now, there actually are two different kinds of nuclear energy. This one, so this is the one I just told you about, nuclear fission. Nuclear fusion atoms combine to form a larger atom, releasing energy. So the idea between nuclear fusion, and David, feel free to step up and speak to this, is that you are fusing either a particle or two atoms together, a particle into an atom or two atoms together, and the result is an atom or an element that has lower binding energy, and so some of the energy that was left behind is released, and that's the energy that's the output of the system here. It's a source of energy in the sun and the stars, so you're trying to when you're trying to make nuclear fusion, you're trying to reproduce the environment in the sun. Nuclear fusion is the subject of ongoing research as potential energy production. It's not yet commercially viable technology due to energy input needed and the complex controlling process. I wonder, David, if you would mind, if I put you on the spot, and just, could you just give us a really short summary of the work that you're doing with low energy nuclear reactors? Would you mind doing that?
Sure.
this is David.
Talk about.
So this is a strong force, and then there's also something called weak force. Uh-huh. So in like a nuclear fission reactor, when you shut down the reactor, you put all of the control rods in it, and the nuclear fission process stops, but it's still hot.
Yes.
It takes a while for it to cool down, so you're still generating heat for a certain period of time. So that's more of the weak force. And so there's an idea of how do you create that heat through that decaying process there. Mm-hmm. So instead of liberating the binding energy or E equals MC squared type of thing, can you create an unstable isotope that will degrade like this fuel here without generating nuclear waste? And that's called the weak force or low energy nuclear reaction. And so there's some ideas about maybe how to create that unstable isotope without doing fission or fusion.
Awesome. So possibly one advantage of that is that it's always going down, it's never ramping up, as in with the uranium neutrons just bombarding and getting bigger and bigger, which is the dangerous part, you know, of a nuclear reactor, it's involving fission. So it sounds like if this works, it could just always be, like, if you took your hands off of it, it would stop running instead of keep running.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that.
And because there's no neutrons being released, you don't have radioactivity, high radioactivity, the nuclear waste left over. So it's essentially
yes.
a clean,
yes,
clean energy source
okay.
with no radioactive material left over.
That's fascinating. So this is David, if you'd like to. I'll like to talk to you about that a little bit more. Thank you for letting me put you on the spot. Okay. So nuclear energy cannot be traced back to the sun, unless, of course, you call the sun the solar system, because the solar system includes the Earth, which has the energy inside it, or the radioactive materials in there. Pros and cons of nuclear energy. Nuclear power is air emissions free. It technically is emissions free. It does not pollute the air. It reduces the amount of electricity generated from fossil fuels, always a plus. You can take a tiny, tiny amount of mass and create an enormous amount of energy. The cons, nuclear waste is produced. It's radioactive. Some countries are making progress researching successful ways to recycling nuclear waste. I know a nuclear physicist who says, yes, there's this total disadvantage that you have nuclear radioactive waste left over. However, when you have carbon emissions, those are just up in the atmosphere. You don't know where they are. They're creating damage. When you have nuclear waste, it's right there in the old fuel rod. You know where it is, and you can have people who guard it for centuries, so it's a really complex subject. Nuclear power takes high-level expertise and adherence to safety regulations to truly work. And I just want to, as a note here, my husband is a radiation health physicist for the Navy, and he's helped me come up with a list of examples of harmless radioactive materials. It is okay for us to be exposed to some radiation. There are low levels of radiation and there are high levels of radiation. Here's some things that might surprise you that are radioactive materials. Bananas, cat litter, manure, fertilizer, granite, fiesta ware, salt substitute, coal, water, and people. Basically, they contain carbon, and this is how we do carbon dating. Because we have to have something that's decaying. It's an unstable element that's decaying in order to have radioactive material. And so organic matter is radioactive, very, very small. And cosmic radiation, which is why you get more exposure to radioactivity when you fly in an airplane. So there's some trivia for you at your next cocktail party. But remember, it always happens like this. You've got something that you're burning to make steam, even in a nuclear reactor, and that's creating that and using the induction to create that electricity. But here's a different one. Here's solar energy. Thanks for staying with me. We're almost done here. You can use solar energy in two forms. Light, you can use photovoltaic systems, in other words, panels, to convert light energy into electricity. No turbines are needed here. These uses are small devices like calculators, watches, and then you can use larger panels of solar cells that can power homes and even cover acres to produce electricity for thousands of homes or business. Or you can use them direct as heat. This came first, really, collecting solar thermal heat energy used for water or to use in homes, buildings or swimming pools, the heat inside of homes, greenhouse and other buildings. It heats fluids to high temperature in solar thermal plants. And as you might expect, it can be traced back to the sun. So in a solar panel, this is a really quick version, the photons or the light energy comes in, excites electrons, and those are driven through a circuit. And so you could have something useful over here, like a light bulb or whatever it is that you're trying to power. This is your grid, and it comes back to the other side of the solar panel and replenishes. So it drives electricity, it drives a current when you have photons hitting your solar panel. And I'm just going to go right here because I know I've got another session coming in at 4:15. Pros. Solar energy systems do not produce air pollutants at all or carbon dioxide. Solar energy systems on buildings have minimal impact on the environment. It's already heating the roof of the building anyway. Amount of sunlight that arrives at the Earth's surface is not constant. It varies depending on location, time of day, season, weather. It's all kind of like hydropower. It's dependent on what season it is. A large surface area is necessary to absorb and collect a useful amount of energy. Locations must be chosen to not block sunlight from reaching the things that are already there that need the sunlight. Solar panels must be made from material, example, silicon, and constructed using energy and mining natural resources. So they have to be built from something. They don't come from nowhere. Biofuels. I'll just go real quickly through this. Biofuels can be ethanol, biodiesel, biomass. So this is alcohol-based. Fat-based, so this is sugar, fat, and just biomass is basically just burning wood or charcoal, which is also wood. Biofuels are used for in place of gasoline for transportation or direct use of burning. Biofuel, the pros are burns much cleaner than petroleum diesel. It reduces carbon emissions. It can be byproducts of other bio uses. It can be grown in unusable spaces. Think of algae in places where you don't, where you're not using it anyway. The cons are that plants require energy and water and fertilizer to grow in the first place. So if you're going to create biofuel, you've got to use farmland that might be useful for something else. It requires land and space, and it can increase the cost of food. So there's a socioeconomic cost to this, because farmland must be shared with other food crops. And I'm going to talk about some other innovations tomorrow at my talk at 2:45. And we do want to minimize our impact and make energy more efficient. And I would say that the practices here at Holden Village are very good models for energy efficient and conservation. And it's the things that you might expect. Using technology that uses less energy and having behaviors that conserve energy. So we discussed various energy methods. How do we get energy from a power plant? How does induction work? And we discussed pros and cons of a lot of different methods. So these are my other two talks this week. The other one's about energy innovations and future stuff. And then this one is my favorite thing, cosmology and astronomy. So I hope you join me. Thank you.
Thank you so much.